grains and shellfish, and for the first time used boats for fishing. But still, it must have been difficult to find enough to feed a large band, and in many places mass starvation caused a precipitous fall in the population. This period of deprivation heralded a complete change in lifestyle from nomadic hunter-gatherer to sedentary farmer. Although in retrospect this change seems dramatic, in fact it must have evolved in slow stages as a result of changing circumstances, and in the end became a matter of necessity. Farming was adopted at different times in different places, and in most areas farmers and hunter-gatherers probably coexisted for a while. But eventually, either voluntarily or by force, persuasion, invasion, or even extermination, almost all hunter-gatherer bands gave way to the more successful farming communities. The domestication of plants and animals evolved independently in at least 9 places around the world, while all others imported domesticated species from these centres. The Fertile Crescent, the region between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, mainly in present-day Iraq and Iran, is famed as the earliest site of domestication. The first farmers grew emmer wheat and herded goats and sheep here from around 8500 BC, and this highly successful new lifestyle spread rapidly to surrounding areas of Asia, North Africa, and Europe, where additional plants and animals more suited to the local conditions were soon added to the imported species. The Chinese began growing rice and keeping pigs around 7500 BC, and a little later several other centres in Africa, Sahel, tropical West Africa, and Ethiopia, and Papua New Guinea also invented farming. Interestingly, the farming lifestyle took hold much later in the Americas, perhaps because there were fewer plant and animal species suitable for domestication. However, from around 3500 BC, Mexican Indians were growing corn, beans, and squash, and farming turkeys, while the people of the South American Andes famously domesticated the potato. By 2500 BC, crops were also being grown in the eastern U.S., but there is no evidence of animal domestication. In theory, a sedentary farming lifestyle has much to recommend it. It provides a permanent home to shelter the young, old, and sick, a ready food supply with the facilities to store the excess, reliable sources of animal and plant materials for making clothes, blankets, ropes, and tools, animals to assist with transport and farm work, and to provide warmth in shared dwellings. With all this in its favour, you might expect the life to be less arduous than hunting and gathering, for the people to be healthier, to live longer, and for the population to grow more rapidly. But at first, this was not the case. The tasks of digging, planting, harvesting, and herding turned out to be more rather than less demanding than hunting and gathering, and archaeological records show that early farmers were smaller, less well-nourished, had a heavier disease burden, and died younger than their hunter-gatherer ancestors. But quite quickly, key discoveries, like the plough and the wheel, made farmers' lives easier and food production more efficient. Then their nutritional state improved, and it was not long before the birth rate began to rise. The interval between children in a family dropped from the hunter-gatherer's average of 4 years to 1 to 2 years, and in the resulting population explosion, farming settlements grew into towns, some eventually becoming large cities. The world's first towns and cities evolved from farming communities in the early centres of domestication, such as Jericho in the Fertile Crescent, and it is no coincidence that it was there, too, that catastrophic epidemics of infectious diseases first struck. These plagues appeared suddenly, as if from nowhere, swept through the population, killing indiscriminately, and then disappeared just as mysteriously. As towns grew bigger and more densely populated, so these ferocious epidemics became more frequent and varied until they threatened the community's survival. So what were these new diseases, and where did they come from? The change from a nomadic to a sedentary farming lifestyle that marked a turning point in human history also heralded a new era for microbes. For the first time, humans had radically and permanently changed the landscape, disrupting naturally balanced ecosystems by clearing forests and scrub areas for planting, and reducing biodiversity by growing crops and farming animals. Microbes that had hitherto either not come into contact with domesticated plant and animal species, or had not been able to leap between isolated groups of individuals, were now handed the opportunity to flourish, and many seized it. Presented with a whole field of wheat or herd of animals, microbes underwent a population explosion in these new host species. Although we have little specific information about the epidemic microbes that infected the first domesticated plants and animals, they must have repeatedly caused famines, spelling deprivation, and even starvation for the early farmers. In contrast to animal and plant microbes, we have plenty of information about the new infectious diseases that hit our ancestors during this period, many of which still cause us problems today. The unprecedented microbe bonanza was triggered by aspects of everyday life in the early farming communities that were absent from hunter-gatherer settlements, the build-up of refuse, a high population density, and close contact with domesticated animals. Without the constant moves typical of the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, all kinds of waste material, including human and animal feces, accumulated in and around the permanent dwellings that families now shared with their livestock. And, lacking any knowledge of the danger it posed, the debris piled up and nobody bothered to clear it away. So early farming communities became a hotbed of parasites. Coprolites, fossilized feces, found among archaeological remains from early farming communities, commonly contain the eggs of intestinal worms, either passed directly from one person to another by fecal-oral contamination, such as roundworms and hookworms, or transmitted by way of intermediate hosts, such as pork or beef tapeworms. These parasites must have spread rapidly in the filthy surroundings, generally picked up by children and then carried for life. But although they may sometimes have caused anemia from intestinal bleeding, worms of this type are not generally life-threatening and would have had little effect on the population as a whole. For microbes that had difficulty finding hosts to infect among the sparse hunter-gatherer bands, the change to fixed communities was a new opening. The population density in the first villages was 10 to 100 times that of hunter-gatherer settlements, so microbes such as Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the cause of tuberculosis, that can only travel short distances between hosts, and Mycobacterium leprae, the cause of leprosy, that is too delicate to survive for long outside the human body, now spread with ease, and skeletal remains show that both TB and leprosy were more common in early farmers than in their hunter-gatherer ancestors. But the most dramatic and long-lasting change in the pattern of human microbes at this time was the direct consequence of the domestication of animals. For the first time, people were living in close contact with herd animals, drinking their milk, butchering and eating their flesh, curing their skins, caring for their young and sick, and sharing their shelter. Many animal microbes took the opportunity to jump ship, finding a new niche in a virgin human population. There is now no doubt that most of the microbes that cause the classic acute childhood infectious diseases, such as smallpox, measles, mumps, diphtheria, whooping cough, and scarlet fever, were originally exclusively animal pathogens that at some time in the past crossed the species barrier to infect humans. Today they only infect humans, but their DNA sequences contain the telltale signs of their past lives. Their closest relatives are among the microbes of domestic animals, and in some cases the molecular clock even pinpoints the timing of their transfer to the early farming era. Perhaps at that time they caused epidemics of relatively mild infections in young animals, just like their human counterparts today. If so, it is easy to see how farmers, having no reason to be cautious or to attribute human disease to their livestock, could have picked them up while tending their sick animals. So our acute childhood infectious diseases were emerging microbes around 5000 BC, equivalent to the emerging infections of the 21st century, like HIV, West Nile fever, and SARS. Whereas we know the cause and can intervene to abort the natural cycles, when an epidemic hit our farming ancestors, they had no notion of what to do. Paralyzed with fear and panic, they often unwittingly assisted the microbe by carrying it with them as they fled, sometimes making for the apparent safety of the nearest town, where the microbe could spread easily among the crowds. Microbes do not usually jump species overnight, but need time to evolve efficient ways of infecting and spreading between their new hosts. At first, microbes often have to be picked up directly from their natural hosts, but generally it is only a matter of time before they adapt to humans and succeed in spreading directly between them. Then they can cause epidemics. And since no one in the early farming communities had either immunity or genetic resistance to these new microbes, epidemics would strike the whole community, causing severe disease, often with a high mortality. But the difference between our modern-day emerging infections and epidemics among early farmers is the number of susceptible human hosts that microbes had at their disposal. So whereas international airliners ferried SARS round the world, potentially exposing millions to the threat before it was even recognized, once an epidemic had infected everyone in a small, isolated early farming community, it had nowhere else to go and would die out. This abortive foray into the human population must have happened many times, perhaps over hundreds of years, before zoonotic microbes finally managed to establish their infectious cycles in humans independently of their natural animal hosts. Critical to this was the size of the population accessible to the microbe, since each one requires a minimum number of susceptible people within reach to establish its never-ending chain of infection. Most is known about measles epidemics in this regard, not least because when the virus was earmarked for global eradication, it was essential to determine the size of the non-vaccinated population below which it could not survive. Measles. The measles virus spreads between us with remarkable ease and is proving a stubborn opponent in the fight to eradicate it. It caused huge epidemics among children worldwide until the first vaccine curtailed its spread in the 1960s. But the virus still causes serious outbreaks where it can get a foothold in pockets of unvaccinated people. And although the overall mortality from measles is less than 1%, it can reach 40% among malnourished children in developing countries. Today, the virus kills around 350,000 children each year. The measles virus colonizes the nasal passages of its victims, establishing a site of infection in the upper respiratory tract. From here, it is shed in airborne droplets for several days before the typical measles rash appears. It has an R0 value of 15, reflecting its high infectivity rate, spreading successfully to around 90% of case contacts. All this is the hallmark of a virus whose life cycle has been highly tuned to its host by natural selection. But when it first encountered our ancestors, it must have been a very different beast. The measles virus has many relatives among members of the morbillivirus family, which infect a wide range of mammals, but it is most closely related to rinderpest virus of cattle, and to a lesser extent, canine distemper virus. All three viruses probably arose from a common ancestor many centuries ago, and by using the molecular clock, scientists pinpoint the divergence of rinderpest and measles viruses to around 2,000 years ago. This date rather satisfyingly suggests that the virus jumped from cattle to humans during the early farming period. Puzzlingly, though, the same type of analysis dates the most recent common ancestor of present-day measles viruses to just 100 to 200 years ago. The only possible explanation for this is that a strain with superior transmission powers spread round the world at that time, replacing all previous strains. Before a vaccine was available, the rinderpest virus caused huge epidemics of cattle plague that swept across Europe, Asia, and Africa, attacking both domestic and wild herds, and killing almost all of those it infected. In the 1890s, it wiped out 80 to 90% of the cattle in South Africa, but fortunately today an eradication campaign has pushed it to the brink of extinction. Like measles, the virus starts by infecting the upper respiratory tract, but then it attacks the gut, causing catastrophic diarrhea and death from dehydration. Since the rinderpest virus spreads through contact with infected secretions and excretions, it is obviously aided by the herding instinct of wild cattle and the overcrowded conditions of some domestic herds. Although today many domestic breeds have some resistance to the virus, this must have been among the most devastating of cattle plagues for early farmers to cope with. The ancestor of modern-day rinderpest and measles viruses probably jumped to humans on many occasions, sparking epidemics of a much more severe disease than we know today. Indeed, it was only differentiated from smallpox in the 10th century AD. But these first epidemics were probably restricted to the local inhabitants of villages and small towns, and once everyone was either dead or immune, the infection would die out until another virus made the transfer from infected cattle. To some extent, this early pattern of infection is recreated by more recent measles epidemics in remote island communities. In 1846, one such epidemic hit the Faroes, a cluster of small Danish islands in the North Atlantic, close to the Arctic Circle, between Norway and Iceland. A carpenter developed measles shortly after arriving by boat from Denmark, the first introduction of the virus for 65 years. Over the next 6 months, it infected 6,000 of the 7,782 islanders, only sparing those over the age of 65 who had suffered measles in the 1781 epidemic. But once the virus had run through the whole susceptible population, it died out, not reappearing until the next time it was introduced from the outside world. Scientists studying this and similar epidemics in other island communities found the same epidemic pattern on islands with small populations, such as Iceland, Greenland, and Fiji, with the chain of infection broken after each epidemic had run its course. Only on islands with larger populations like Hawaii could the measles virus maintain its infectious cycle and circulate continuously. Using this information, researchers calculate that the minimum number of people required to maintain the virus permanently in a city environment is around 500,000. A similar figure probably applies to most other airborne acute infectious disease microbes, so when and where could these so-called crowd diseases have first taken hold in the human population? The world's oldest civilization arose in Mesopotamia, the Roman name for the Fertile Crescent area, where the first farming villages evolved from hunter-gatherer settlements on the fertile Sinjar Plain near modern-day Baghdad. As the population grew, villages expanded into towns and cities at the center of trade, industry and government, probably reaching a population of 500,000 inhabitants sometime around 5,000 years ago. This date fits comfortably with the approximate date for the divergence of measles from the Rinderpest virus, so this and many other zoonotic microbes probably cut their ties with their animal hosts and threw their lot in with humans around this time. And as these and other cities in the great civilizations of Egypt, Greece, India, and China reached the critical size, so microbes must have taken hold in their inhabitants, causing devastating epidemics. Indeed, it is clear from ancient written records in the Egyptian medical papyri, dating from around 1850 BC, Chinese medical texts from 1300 BC and the books of the Old Testament written between 1000 and 500 BC, that epidemics were a major problem to these ancient civilizations, regularly killing a sizable proportion of the population. In Exodus, we read of the horrifying plagues of Egypt, which, apart from unpleasantly large swarms of frogs, flies, locusts, and lice, included a terrible pestilence in the form of boils breaking forth with blains. And in the first book of Samuel, the poor Philistines were hit by emrods of their secret parts, probably enlarged glands in the groin, possibly caused by bubonic plague, which they interpreted as a divine punishment for stealing the Israelites' Ark of the Covenant. But when they returned, the plague spread to the Israelites as well. Leprosy is another frequently mentioned disease in the Old Testament and early Eastern texts, the first clear account being in the Indian Charaka Samhita, written around 300 to 200 BC. Mycobacterium leprae, the bacterium causing leprosy, which spreads only poorly between humans, seems to have moved westwards along trade routes from India and China, causing a pandemic that reached its peak in the 13th and 14th centuries. Depending on the state of the sufferer's immunity, M. leprae may cause chronic skin lesions, destroy nerves, produce deformities, particularly of the face and hands, and invade and destroy internal organs. But in medieval times, the term leprosy was used to describe any chronic skin condition, and since lepers were considered contagious, they became social outcasts, traditionally condemned to live in isolated colonies or to wear distinctive clothing and announce their presence by ringing a bell. We will pick up this subject again in Chapter 5 when considering yours, another chronic skin infection that was originally included in the term leprosy. Despite the frequent and ferocious epidemics that hit the early civilizations of the Old World, over a longer timescale the population grew so that towns were continually expanding, growing ever more crowded, dirty, and unhygienic as the years passed, an open invitation to pathogenic microbes. Looking back to these times, it is not possible to identify with any degree of confidence the microbes that caused the many epidemics described in ancient texts. This is partly because early descriptions often lack clinical details, and so diseases such as measles and smallpox, where rash is a prominent feature, are indistinguishable, but also because the diseases have very likely changed their character in the intervening years. Most would have begun by causing severe zoonotic infections. Only once they were established as purely human pathogens could they co-evolve with their host, a process that takes around 150 years and generally results in milder disease. Ancient Egypt. Much of the medical history of ancient Egypt is preserved in medical papyri and the embalmed bodies of Egyptian mummies, giving us a unique glimpse of the microbes that affected the people of one of the world's great early civilizations. In Mesolithic times, modern-day Egypt was populated by just a few thousand hunter-gatherers clustered in small, isolated settlements along the Nile Valley. The change to farming began around 6000 BC, when wheat, goats, and sheep were imported from the Fertile Crescent. Conditions along the Tigris and Euphrates were very similar to those of the Nile Valley, and these new farming practices quickly became productive. Egypt has very little rain, but before the Aswan Dam was built in 1902, the River Nile used to flood once a year, covering the valley for more than a mile on either side and depositing a rich sediment that kept the soil fertile. To preserve this valuable water, a system of irrigation farming evolved along the Nile, as well as the Euphrates and Tigris valleys, with a network of channels running between the fields to water the cereal crops. A similar system also developed in the Indus Valley in modern-day Pakistan and on the Yellow River floodplain in China, where it was used for watering rice paddies. In Egypt, this highly successful change in lifestyle produced the rapid population growth that heralded the ancient Egyptian civilization. The first large cities appeared around 2500 BC, at the same time as the famous Sphinx and pyramids of Giza were built. Papyrus scrolls written by Egyptian physicians around this time describe common human ailments and their treatments. The Edwin Smith Surgical Papyrus, a 1700 BC copy of one thought to date from 3000 BC, details the pest of the year, an epidemic that struck Egypt annually. Experts think that this may have been malaria arriving each year as the Nile flooded, providing an ideal breeding ground for mosquitoes. This suspicion is backed up by studies on 5,000-year-old mummies from Gebelein and Assiut in the Luxor region of Upper Egypt, apparently a swampy area at the time. Just under half of the mummies show evidence of P. falciparum infection, and interestingly, several also show signs suggestive of thalassemia and sickle cell anemia, the inherited blood disorders that protect from malaria. And since these genes take thousands of years to become common in malaria-exposed populations, this finding implies that the malaria parasite had been around in Egypt for a long time. Egyptian mummies also commonly contained intestinal parasites, and several skeletons show evidence of TB, but probably the most problematic infection at the time was schistosomiasis, a fatal disease caused by a waterborne microbe that exploits irrigation farming to aid its spread. Schistosomiasis. This ancient parasitic disease is still a major public health problem today, infecting around 200 million people in over 70 countries, of which Egypt is a major focus. Descriptions that almost certainly refer to schistosomiasis and remedies for treating it are common in Egyptian papyri, particularly the Kaun papyrus dating from 1850 BC and the papyrus Abers of 1550 BC. The latter describes another excellent remedy for those prepared for the belly. Grind one aisu and one shamez finely and boil with honey. Should be eaten by a man in whose belly there are worms. The hematuria, bloody urine, produces them, and they are not killed by any other remedy. Although there may be some debate about whether these descriptions really refer to schistosomiasis, the parasite's eggs found in the kidneys of two mummies dating from the 20th dynasty, spanning 1250 to 1000 BC, leaves no doubt that the microbe infected the ancient Egyptians. And since schistosomes have also been uncovered in a well-preserved body buried in China around 200 BC, the microbe was obviously widespread in the ancient world. Schistosomiasis is caused by a parasitic blood fluke, the schistosome, derived from the Greek word schistos, meaning split, and soma, meaning body, and denoting the groove of the male in which he holds the female. The disease begins with an acute feverish illness as the parasite enters the body, but it is the long-term consequences of the infection, manifesting some 2 to 10 years later, that are the most serious problem. The microbe's eggs cause inflammation, gouge out ulcers, and induce scarring around the bladder or intestine. Depending on the site, the sufferer experiences chronic bloody diarrhea or hematuria, with death from liver or kidney failure. The microbe can also predispose to bladder cancer, and even today schistosomiasis is among the leading causes of the tumour in endemic areas. There are three main types of schistosomes, all with similar life cycles, but they use different species of water snail as intermediate hosts. Two of these, S. mansoni and S. japonicum, target the gut, but the common type in Egypt, S. haematobium, has a particular predilection for the bladder, so hematuria has always been the most common and obvious symptom there. The microbe particularly affected young men, and indeed the Ebers papyrus contains a drawing of a penis supposedly discharging blood, a symptom so common that the Roman historian Herodotus is said to have referred to Egypt as the land where men menstruate. The schistosome is sometimes called the Bilharzia worm after Theodor Bilharz, the German doctor who discovered it in human tissues and its eggs in human excreta while working at the Casa Elaini Hospital in Cairo in 1852. But he had no concept then of the parasite's complex existence, and there followed nearly 60 years of controversy before its mode of spread and life cycle, including its intermediate host, the water snail, were finally unravelled. For a while, people thought that humans ingested the parasite, perhaps by eating spicy food or drinking contaminated water. But other routes also had their vogue. Maybe it entered through the anus or urethra, possibly during masturbation. From early times, the Egyptians realized that the disease was associated with water, and since the most prominent symptom was hematuria, they assumed it gained access through the urethra and devised protective penile sheaths to be worn while hunting in the marshes. The schistosome attacked Napoleon's troops while they were stranded in Egypt in 1800, and British soldiers also suffered severely while fighting the Boer War in South Africa in 1899. With the outbreak of the First World War in 1914 and their troops heading for Egypt, the British government urgently needed the problem solved. In 1915, the British War Office sent parasitologist Lieutenant Colonel Robert Thompson Leeper to Cairo with the express purpose of sorting out the parasite's transmission route. He did not take long to come up with the answer. The ferocious little beasts burrow their way through the intact skin of people wading or swimming in contaminated water. Flukes have separate male and female forms, and once they have got inside the body, they make their way to the veins surrounding the intestine and bladder, where they mate. The female then deposits her eggs, hundreds to thousands a day, theoretically up to 600 billion in a lifetime. which enter the bladder or gut lumen and return to the outside world in urine and feces. In fresh water, the eggs hatch and the new parasites then seek out their intermediate host, the water snail. They multiply inside the mollusk before once again being released into the water to complete their cycle by finding another human host to infect. Water snails live in slow-flowing fresh water, and it is their habits that define the world distribution of the schistosomiasis. The irrigation channels along the Nile and in other areas of Africa and the Middle East, as well as the rice paddies of China and Japan, make ideal habitats, and with farmers wading barefoot in this contaminated water, it is not surprising that the schistosome flourishes. But humans and water snails seem an unlikely pair of hosts for a parasite, so how did this combination evolve? Apparently, schistosome-like flukes have parasitized marine snails for at least 200 million years. The free-swimming larvae are clearly opportunistic, attempting to colonize any potential new hosts, leading to numerous host switches throughout history. At some stage, they infected marine birds as a second host, and now use many mammal and freshwater snail species, perhaps invading humans when irrigation farming brought them into close contact for the first time. Microbes exploit trade and war. As the population of the Old World grew and its towns and cities expanded, each had its own local set of epidemic infectious diseases. Then, as trading networks opened up and reached previously isolated villages, so their microbes were shared and their infectious disease pools merged with those of the surrounding communities. And the more this happened, the further microbes travelled, until they were being carried across the Mediterranean and Indian Ocean by merchant ships, along with their cargoes of corn, wine, and olive oil. Similarly, caravans travelling the Silk Road to bring luxuries from China to the Middle East also brought less welcome visitors, their local microbes, spreading them to virgin populations. Plagues became a constant feature of the times, and eventually a single infectious disease pool enveloped the whole of the Old World. Like trade, warfare was a sure way for microbes to travel and spawn epidemics in virgin populations, as one after another the great Egyptian, Assyrian, Persian, Greek, and Roman empires rose and fell. Conflict, invasion, and war were commonplace and inevitably sparked epidemics. With recruits drafted from widely differing backgrounds, housed in cramped and unsanitary army camps, stationed in overcrowded, war-torn towns, constantly on the move, and subject to stress, injury, and malnutrition, it is no wonder that microbes decimated armies and spread from there to civilian populations. Time and again, epidemics disrupted military operations and often determined the final outcome of wars, although it is impossible to identify most of the microbes that beset the armies of the ancient world. Three so-called plagues, although not necessarily caused by classic bubonic plague, of classical Greco-Roman times have been particularly well studied. These are the plague of Athens in 430 BC, the Antonine Plague in AD 166, and the Justinian Plague in AD 542, each of which had far-reaching consequences. The Plague of Athens. The legendary rivalry between the great cities of ancient Greece regularly erupted into the conflict that dogged the empire and ultimately led to its downfall. And although their separate armies had united to defeat the Persians when Xerxes threatened to invade in 480 to 479 BC, old jealousies soon resurfaced. By 431 BC, Athens and Sparta were again at loggerheads in the Peloponnesian War, which lasted on and off for 27 years. Athens, with her mighty navy, was pitted against the vastly superior and well-disciplined Spartan infantry, and Pericles, ruler of Athens, resolved not to confront the Spartans head-on. Instead, he decided to fortify the city and sit out the siege until the Spartans called for a truce. He enclosed Athens, including the port of Piraeus, within wooden walls, intending to use the port's access to the sea as the city's lifeline. When all agreed to this ingenious strategy to preserve the city by avoiding direct conflict, no one could have foreseen the terrible consequences. As the Spartans advanced, thousands of refugees from the surrounding countryside headed for the safety of Athens, so that the city, with its mere 10,000 dwellings and no route out except by sea, housed a seething mass of people, an ideal setting for a microbe to take hold. When the epidemic struck in 430 BC, it was so virulent and widespread that it spelt defeat for the Athenians, thus contributing to the end of the golden age of Greek culture and their dominance of the ancient world. This is the oldest epidemic ever recorded, documented by the contemporary historian Thucydides. According to him, it began abruptly and rampaged for 4 years, killing around a quarter of the population, military and civilian alike. The Athenian army lost 4,400 foot soldiers and 300 cavalrymen, over a quarter of their front line. But most importantly, Pericles himself was among the casualties, and his death not only deprived the Athenians of their great leader, but also demoralized a people already ravaged by war and plague. No physical evidence of the plague survives, so to decide on the specific nature of the culprit microbe, experts must interpret Thucydides' text as best they can. He is clear that the disease affected all ages, killed in 7 to 9 days, describing it thus. Internally, the heat was so intense that the victims could not endure the laying on of even the lightest wraps and linens. Indeed, nothing would suffice but that they must go naked, and a plunge into cold water would give the greatest relief. Many who were left unattended actually did this, jumping into wells, so unquenchable was the thirst which possessed them, but it was all the same, whether they drank much or little. Thucydides also lists the other symptoms, starting with sore eyes and throat, cough, sneezing, blisters, sores, and foul breath, proceeding to retching, convulsions, and a red rash, and finally diarrhea, sleeplessness, gangrene, and loss of memory and sight, and death from exhaustion. But his description does not tie up with any infectious disease we know today. Smallpox is favored by most experts, measles or typhoid by others. Indeed, it may have been a mixture of infectious diseases, all raging in the appalling conditions created by the siege. Interestingly, the Spartan army seemed to be spared the plague, so perhaps they were already immune to the microbe. It is even possible that they were the source of it, bringing along with their arms a disease which they were already familiar with, but which was new and lethal to the Athenians. The plague of Athens was devastating, not just because of the huge numbers it killed, but by its effect on the living. Thucydides describes the change in personal attitudes thus. They saw how sudden was the change of fortune in the case, both of those who were prosperous and suddenly died, and of those who before had nothing, but in a moment were in possession of the property of others. Incidentally, the Greek Empire was similarly left rudderless in 323 BC by the sudden death of the legendary Alexander the Great while at the height of his power. This extraordinary young man led his Macedonian troops against the Persians, conquering their great empire and eventually controlling an area stretching from Egypt to the Indus Valley. But then, shortly after sailing down the Euphrates from Babylon to inspect the marshlands near the Arabian border, he developed a fever, and in less than 2 weeks, this healthy 33-year-old leader was dead. There were no epidemics around at the time, so it seems reasonable to assume that Alexander's death was related to his marshland trip. It could have been malaria, but he suffered from continuous fever for 11 days, which sounds more like typhoid, caused by a bacterium spread by fecal contamination of food or water. After his death, the empire was split between his generals, and a period of unrest ensued that contributed to the demise of his Greater Greece. The Antonine Plague. This plague, the least well documented of the three, hit the Roman Empire at its height. From the magnificent city of Rome, with more than 1 million inhabitants, Emperor Marcus Aurelius Antoninus ruled over an area stretching from Britain in the west through Europe to the Middle East and North Africa. The very extent of this multicultural, multinational empire, with its traders free to operate in any province and its armies constantly on the march, provided a network of highways for microbes which could hitch a ride with travellers and spark off epidemics wherever they went. The source of the Antonine Plague was probably the city of Seleucia on the River Tigris near modern-day Baghdad. Roman troops, sent to quell an uprising, sacked and plundered the city and then returned triumphant, spreading the plague along their route and bringing it home to Rome, where at its height it killed around 5,000 people a day. Eventually it spread over the whole empire and beyond to India and China, lasting several decades, and still raging when the Emperor Marcus Aurelius died in AD 180. The renowned physician Galen of Pergamum relates in his Methodus Medendi that the disease struck indiscriminately at rich and poor, young and old alike, killing between a third and a half of those it infected. He describes a fever plague, causing intense heat and thirst, vomiting and diarrhea, all very similar to the plague of Athens. But this time there is a clear description of a dry, black, ulcerated rash covering the whole body, which Galen attributes to a remnant of blood which had putrefied in the fever blisters. This description, particularly of the rash, leaves little doubt that the plague was smallpox, possibly the first of its kind in Europe. But some experts still favour typhus as the cause, maintaining that in its early stages it cannot be distinguished from smallpox. The Romans believed the plague was divine punishment for their deeds in the city of Seleucia, where soldiers sacked the temple of Apollo and opened an ancient sealed tomb. As the contemporary historian Ammianus Marcellinus wrote, "When the Roman soldiers opened it up, pestilence issued forth, bringing contagion and death all over the empire from the borders of Iran to the Rhine River and Gaul." The Antonine Plague caused such a calamitous drop in population that the Roman Empire, critically reliant on manpower for its every function, began to founder. Towns and fields stood empty, the army was depleted, trade and commerce stagnated, and the people were confused and demoralized. This marked the onset of a decline lasting for the next 100 years, with constant invasions, wars, and plagues. In AD 266, the Emperor Valerian was taken prisoner by the Iranians, and the extremities of the empire to the east and west were lost. These struggles continued until Constantine the Great moved the capital of the empire to Byzantium, renaming it Constantinople, and in 396 the empire split into its Latin western and Greek eastern halves. The Justinian Plague. After the centuries of strife, the Emperor Justinian managed briefly to reconquer North Africa, Italy, and Spain, and to reunite the Roman Empire in the 6th century AD. But when plague struck Constantinople, it heralded a series of epidemic cycles that lasted for 2 centuries. It marked the end of the empire, the relative isolation of Europe in the West, and the expansion of Islam in the East. In Constantinople, the Justinian Plague lasted for a year, killing a quarter of the population, 10,000 people a day at its height. Constantine himself survived an attack, but as the epidemic surged, both east and west throughout the empire, it left few in its wake to perform essential tasks, and he was powerless to protect the newly united territories. The overall death toll in the 2 empires is estimated at 100 million. The Byzantium chronicler Procopius of Caesarea states that the plague began in Pelusium in Egypt, spreading from there to Alexandria and on via Palestine to Constantinople. He described the symptoms in such detail that most experts are in no doubt that this was bubonic plague with its characteristic hugely swollen glands, buboes. The fever, from morning to night, was so slight that neither the patients nor the physician feared danger, and no one believed that he would die. But in many, even on the first day, in others on the day following, in others again not until later, a bubo appeared, both in the inguinal regions and under the armpits, in some behind the ears, and in any part of the body whatsoever. To this point, the disease was the same in everyone, but in the later stages there were individual differences. Some went into a coma, others violent delirium. If they neither fell asleep nor became delirious, the swelling gangrened, and these died of excess pain. It was not contagious to touch, since no doctor or private individual fell ill from the sick or dead. For many who nursed or buried remained alive in their service, contrary to all expectations. Some died at once, others after many days, and the bodies of some broke out in black blisters, the size of a lentil. These did not live after 1 day, but died at once, and many were quickly killed by a vomiting of blood which attacked them. Physicians could not tell which cases were light and which severe, and no remedies availed. This was perhaps the first epidemic of bubonic plague in Europe. It raged for 200 years, mysteriously disappeared for 600 years, and then, as we shall see in the next chapter, reappeared in the guise of the Black Death. We do not know for certain the cause of any of these epidemics, and earlier writers were confident that we never should. But now that new molecular probes can detect the faintest fingerprints of microbes, finding the answer is a real possibility. Plague victims are being excavated from mass burial sites, so it may just be a matter of time before the microbes that cause these devastating epidemics and pandemics are revealed. Sometime around AD 1200, these terrible, unpredictable epidemics gave way to a cyclical pattern, with microbes visiting a community and causing an epidemic only when there were enough susceptible people to sustain their chains of infection. And since recovery from these acute infectious diseases gives lifelong protection, only children born since the last epidemic were susceptible to the next. So the pattern of childhood epidemics, like that of measles, was established, and, as each cycle weeded out the most susceptible children, over generations, resistance built up in the population, and the infections became less severe. But as we shall see in the next chapter, the acute infectious diseases remained a threat, especially to children in towns and cities where increasing crowding, poverty, and unsanitary conditions encouraged their spread. 4. Crowds, filth, and poverty. In medieval Europe, virtually everyone was infested with blood-sucking parasites, and their homes were colonized by equally infested mice and rats. Most people in farming villages lived along with their livestock in tiny, single-story thatched hovels, which were dark, cramped, and airless. As the population expanded and small communities grew into towns, the situation got steadily worse. With no facilities for waste disposal, everything was thrown out into the narrow lanes that ran between the dwellings so that these dark, dank conduits became quagmires of mud, human and animal excreta and garbage, most of which ended up in the rivers that served as the water supply. In these unhygienic surroundings, it is no wonder that microbes flourished. Almost all their transmission routes were facilitated by the appalling conditions. Poor ventilation and overcrowding made life easy for airborne microbes. Non-existent sanitation meant that gut pathogens had easy access to food and water, and lack of personal hygiene allowed vectors like fleas and lice to prosper. Not surprisingly, medieval towns and cities were extremely unhealthy places to live. Their inhabitants had a lower life expectancy than their country cousins, and it was not until the beginning of the 20th century that European cities could sustain their own population. But in medieval Europe, the vast majority of people lived and worked on country estates where a distinct class system operated, with peasants tied to the manor, working land which belonged to the lord of the manor in return for services rendered. Towns and cities relied on these surrounding estates not only for imports of consumables like grain, meat, and wood, but also for manpower, attracting country youths to the urban life with the prospect of better wages. All too often, this was a one-way ticket to death from one of the acute infections endemic in towns, which they had hitherto escaped in the healthier countryside. Despite the unhealthy environment in its cities, Europe experienced an unprecedented population explosion during the 11th and 12th centuries, and by the middle of the 13th century, people were outgrowing natural resources. Good agricultural land was in short supply, and severe underemployment inevitably led to poverty. By the 14th century, with the Little Ice Age well underway, the drop in temperature caused crop yields to fall and regular famines ensued. Throughout this period of population growth, more people travelled further than ever before, be it for the purposes of trade, war, or pilgrimage, taking their microbes with them and broadcasting them like seeds along the way. Merchant ships crossed the Mediterranean with ever-increasing frequency, and Europeans set up trading centres as far afield as Africa, India, and the Far East. At the same time, local skirmishes between European cities as well as international wars meant that troops were always on the move, while the Crusades of the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries saw large Christian armies heading east across Europe for Jerusalem to challenge the Saracens. More often than not, crusaders were turned back by epidemic diseases like dysentery, typhoid, and smallpox that ravaged their troops and sparked epidemics in their home countries. Meanwhile, the vast Eastern Mongol Empire, established under Genghis Khan, eventually incorporated the whole of modern-day China and most of Russia, and stretched through Central Asia to Iran and Iraq in the west. Its capital, Karakorum, was the hub of a trading network, linking all the large and flourishing cities of the empire and beyond to Europe. The old Silk Road between China and Syria was re-established and used by literally thousands of traders, soldiers, post-riders and ambassadors, travelling from oasis to oasis and covering vast distances. When the Venetian Marco Polo, 1254 to 1324, set out on his epic journey in 1271, travelling the Silk Road through Armenia, Persia, and Afghanistan, over the Pamirs and through the Gobi Desert to Beijing, a distance of 5,600 miles and taking 3.5 years to complete, he certainly never spared a thought for the microbes he might pick up or pass on along the way. But there is little doubt that the opening up of this and other international trading routes, with the inevitable